timeout. Cancel.
Stay by the timeout. I'm reading this, and I want to see if I can convey this without see if anybody follows the way they're trying to explain this experiment that was done. So stand by, because I just want to catch up and see if I can just get the important, the most pertinent points across. I'll be right back.
Can I make a comment while you read?
Yeah, go ahead.
I recall you just mentioned reading, you know, word for word, the paper. You said Johnson noise, you know, Johnson-Nyquist noise. You know, another term would just be thermal noise. And this paper must be pretty old if it still doesn't realize, you know, tube flicker noise. I'm pretty sure, you know, I don't do older electronics. I usually stick with semiconductor materials. But, you know, that's pretty sure nowadays everyone recognizes it as, you know, shocking noise, even though it's not a shocking material, but, you know, that's what it is.
Also, Patrick Sheehan, that which you called convoluted, minority-majority charges, carriers, I'm sorry, related to PNN type of dope semiconductors. It's a radiation dosimetry that is applied to that, and this is the major source of the noise in semiconductor. So if we're dealing with a semiconductor that is doped for the purpose of modulating its electrical optical structure properties, then we'll be dealing with that noise. Interesting.
Wesley, your mic's a little on the hot side.
Okay. How about now?
Still a bit hot.
How about now?
Much better. You could inch it up a little bit more, but it's perfect audio. Hear every syllable.
Thank you very much for that.
All right, very good. The reason why I'm hesitating, so looking at this, because I don't want to go over people's heads. Meaning that, you know, you give too much information that you're not going to understand it, you know, unless you understand some of the basics. This paper here, and the other station that did mention I forgot what you said. The noise that's good. It later on in this article there is a mention of the other type of noise that you just mentioned, which I just forgot. But again, I'm looking over, and I want to see if I can convey some information that would be understandable to most of the people in the audience listening to this, rather than you know, something I'm going to say that makes no sense, because I don't want to for obvious reasons I don't want to just ramble on, and no one understands what I'm talking about. So let me, you know, in keeping with the with the theories that that this article talks about with transistors and semiconductors, that's what I want to relate to. It's just going into some experiments here, and has to do with biasing of the component, which I mentioned earlier. So let me let it drop. And Roy, if you want to come in for a minute while I'm looking over this, because I want to make sure that I can convey this information pretty easily. Back to you.
Okay, this is AC2GS. And the term that was used, I believe, was shocking noise, which I thought that generally was used to describe the noise generated by devices like accelerators and such.
Shocking was the word I was looking for. Yeah, that's the latest term that's used. And there is, it happens to be a diode called the Schottky diode, which has an interesting characteristic. It's it doesn't even use a PN junction. It uses either N or P type material, but then the other half is a it's not a semiconductor. It's a conductor. It's a metal. And I understand the speed, the recovery time, and the speed of the diode is much quicker. It's used in power supplies because of the switching speed that they use, the switching power supplies use. So that's a Schottky diode. I'm just curious, the other station who was just, who mentioned Schottky, what's your caller name? I just want to get that.
Here is KDJFJB, Kilo Delta 2, Fox Julia Bravo. The name here is Lee. And, yeah, it's, you know, it's not named Schottky for, you know, the diode, but for the person who also, of course, you know, discovered the asymmetric Schottky diode. But, yeah, it's, you know, I guess another term, if we wanted to be precise about this, is, you know, we could also call Schottky noise poison noise. But, you know, that's, you know, if we're, I don't know what your end goal here with, you know, reading this paper is, but if you're trying to summarize, you know, the different types of inherent semiconductor noise, you know, we're basically summarizing it down to thermal noise, you know, Schottky noise or shock noise, I guess, is another term people like using, and what else, avalanche noise, I guess. So, you know, there's that, if that helps any.
Well, you seem to be knowledgeable in the area, you know, more so than most. I don't, you know, as far as the general audience, that's why I, okay, Lee, I got your name. I don't think I've heard you on the repeater. No, this whole segment, and again, I'm trying to, you know, have a technical discussion on something that is related to amateur radio, and of course, you know, we have solid-state and tube radio equipment that, you know, it generates noise. And as I said earlier, it's one of the specifications is the signal-to-noise ratio of a receiver and what makes a receiver a good receiver as opposed to a one that has a poor signal-to-noise ratio because, you know, like I said earlier, everything generates noise. To a degree, resistors, diodes, transistors, and so on. So I came across this article basically just to sort of fill in time, to, you know, to have something technically discussed on the tech net that would be sort of interesting to talk about. But, you know, the problem is, you know, going into the article itself, it's going to be... a little bit hard to follow because of the way that this paper is discussed. Again, this was written back in 1952, so this is old. But it deals with noise, and since noise is important to understand in our field, that's why I'm mentioning it. All right, I'll give it back to you, Lee, just for that comment.
Yeah, sure. You know, when you were talking about transceiver and noise, I thought you were talking about, you know, spurious emissions. You know, the, was it 97, 307 or 305, I want to say, you know, 60 dB or like 40, 30 dB, you know, spurious emissions requirements for filtering. I guess you were talking about receive noise instead.
Yes, receiver noise because of the one of the specifications is the signal-to-noise ratio as far as the sensitivity is concerned, measuring sensitivity of a receiver and using that the signal-to-noise ratio factor that is provided by the manufacturer what it should be. Comment, go ahead. I think it's Wesley.
Yeah, you also mentioned fast diet. Not sure if I'm not mistaken, but my understanding is that when we're dealing with diets, we're dealing only with PON. It would be P or N. If we deal with transistor, we have NPN or PO, PNP. Right, but the speed that is related to noise. We're talking about the minority carrier that you called on for convoluted before, which is actually very important. So minority carrier lifetime is the average time that the minority carrier spends in a semiconductor from generation to recombination. And the faster you have, the more noise you have. The only that is shorter. And tertiary.
Yes, exactly, and it does go into that discussion of minority carriers, but it gets a little mathematical, and it's a little bit convoluted the way it'll be hard to explain it. So that's why I'm looking over the these pages to see if this would work tonight as an opening discussion. For my Andy's Corner, which I have, I have a lot of other articles. There's actually another one that I'm actually looking for, which is in dealing with noise, but on a different level. It's not on semiconductors. It's noise in receivers itself, and how that applies. So, it's good because it's a start. Anyway, it's a start for me because it's been a while since I've been on the on this TechNet, talking about something of this nature. Anyway, so just bear with me. I see it's already 9:15. But now that I'm looking it over, and I it gets a little bit on the deep side, and I don't want to do that because it's not going to be something that's going to be easily figured out as I look through this to see or easily understood over time. I'm just reading it through here as I hold the microphone keyed to see if this would work. So right now I just went to the last page, and again it gets a little bit on the deep side. The point is, There's another article that I'm looking for. I haven't found it yet. I can't find it because I've been looking for a while, and I want to see if I could get that article, and it will be a little bit easier to understand than this one. But noise again. We could talk about many areas of noise. This particular article is again semiconductors, but there is other. Since it's such a broad subject to talk about, we can have other discussions. Okay, with that, Roy, let me give it back to you for a final comment, and I'm going to do further research on this before I put everybody to sleep, which I don't want to do. I just want to keep it on the technical side. AC2GS, WHSTVO, back to you.
Okay, did you have to be with a quick question?
Lee, I've never heard you before. I'm on the air, so you sound new. So that's why I asked you. Gad, Lee.
Yeah, very good. I just pop on whenever I'm in the area, and usually am not frequently able to hop on. So, when I have some free time, and I'm just waiting for some stuff to get back to me, I figure I'd jump onto your repeater. My question here is simply this. Is your goal here to be an academic roundtable discussion, or is it more a you know, technical application sort of discussion, because if I had to guess, a lot more people might appreciate, you know, amateurs, I'd imagine, are very handy. You know, they want to work with, you know, projects, and they would probably want to discuss, you know, technical aspects of projects that they're working on, as opposed to, you know, going to an IEEE conference, which, you know, I'm happy to meet up and break bread with all of you at. But, you know, it doesn't seem like a net would be appropriate for that sort of thing.
I believe that doesn't. Roy, you would be able to answer because you have two sections for the technique. Literally.
Yeah, Wes, give Andy a chance to respond to Levo.
Here, off the Sheldon repeater.
Oh, wait, hold on a second. What was that, Rich, on Sheldon? What happened?
It just went dead. I heard nothing after he stopped transmitting.
All right, stand by 1 second. Stand by. Okay. Is this working? It's working now. Do you hear me now, Rich?
I hear you now, Andy.
All right, let's see if I, I'll let you, I'll let you know if I drop out, at least I'll know if that happens. Okay. Yeah, Lee, so to answer your question, I'm just trying to keep the net as a technical net. That's the goal, and just convey information. We can have a roundtable discussion on you know, on a certain topic where we can pass it around to other people, and that's what people do. Like Wesley comes in and other people, and they make comments about whatever subject we're talking about. But I want to my goal is to keep something that's technical, that's associated with amateur radio or pertinent to amateur radio, and because we hams are all curious and, you know, like yourself, and we want to know how things work, one of the important points is, noise that affects our radios that we use. Either whether it be atmospheric noise on HF or noise generated in our radios itself from these semiconductor devices. So basically, it's my goal is just to convey information, and then to have people have more knowledge of what's going on. Mainly, in this case, inside their radio, because it uses semiconductors and it generates noise, they generate noise. So that's my goal, and to keep it under in that aspect. Lee, back to you.
Very good. More power to you. Nothing further from me. So I guess I should say thank you for the TechNet. Back to Net Control.
Oh, okay. I'm sort of experimenting now to see how this is going to work out without taking up too much time. We'll see how things go in the future, and I'll come up with other noise articles that there's quite a few. The thing is, it's just we're just talking on the air. I can't obviously talk anything mathematical because you can't see a mathematical equation, and you can't discuss it without seeing it and talk about it to really understand it. And of course, the illustrations, which a lot of these articles have, it's hard to convey an illustration. So mainly it's just words, you know, of how things work and why it works and what it does. This particular paper is going a little bit, not so mathematical, but a little bit, you know, the wording that they use, it's a little bit hard to understand because the way it's written. I guess it's written by engineers for engineers. And got to keep it in that realm. But, you know, again, the bottom line is I'm trying to keep it as on a technical aspect. Yeah, because, you know, because it's a tech net. So that's my point. Okay, with that, thanks. Roy, back to you, and I'm going to see if I can find something else. And thanks for letting me in. We will continue in the future. It'll be good. KC2GS, WA2CDL. Whatever people got out of it, it will be good. Back to you.
VDH with a quick comment.
Yes, go ahead. VDH, I'd like to get first names of everyone. What's your name again? Because I forgot. Is it John?
John. Related with Pauline. Anyway, you might want to concentrate on noise figure and signal noise ratio and stuff like that. I think that's what a lot of amateurs really want to know about when they see that spec. Just my humble opinion.
Exactly. The problem is it gets mathematical and it's hard to it's hard to convey an equation without actually seeing it and understanding it. In this particular paper, it goes into Boltzmann's constant. It shows the formula because it's dealing with noise, obviously. And, you know, that's the hard part. You know, Roy and I have discussed that a few times as far as conveying information the thing is, I have to extract from a paper a way of conveying information so everyone understands it without illustrations and mathematics. That's the difficulty. If this was a Zoom meeting, which we could do that, you could have a Zoom technical net. We can actually see on a chalkboard, I call it chalkboard. You know, what's going on, it'd be a lot easier to see. But, John, that's my point. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah, I understand exactly what you mean. Yeah, it is hard to convey some of those things. But you're approaching it the right way. You're trying to keep it light and not too mathematical, which is the way to go, because you don't want to get all bogged down in the mathematics, because some of that math can get very hairy, very fast. They start going into a stochastic process, and that becomes a nightmare, believe me.
Yeah, exactly. I have no idea who's listening to this. We usually don't, I don't think Roy takes check-ins of how many people, you know, actually check into a tech net where we write calls down and write, you know, people's names and so on. It's not easy to do. Okay, maybe that's a good idea I came up with. We'll have a Zoom tech net thing. You know, we could do that. Okay, no problem, John. I appreciate that. And of course, you're knowledgeable because I've heard you on many times as well as many other people, but come on. All right. Well, it is 9:30, so it did take 45 minutes since we started, so I guess the timing is just about right. Even though Paul is under the weather, that's what Roy said, and so he probably won't be on. But anyway, it's good because it keeps it within the realm of the tech net anyway. Roy, back to you, AC2GS, WHCDL.
Can I make a comment?
Yes.
My understanding is that people sometimes are tired from science section because they may not understand it very well. But noise is an extremely important factor for ham radio operators. So I would say that if it is mentioned that source of noise in semiconductor is spontaneous fluctuation in current and voltage, and that it depends from the type of manufacturing process and operating conditions, and then we could go to just quickly that is created the noise models and defining inherent noise is created for the particular device. So we don't have much actually to differ with. What is it, BJT? What is it called? Junction field effect? JFET, metal oxide semiconductor field effect transistor, and we have a MOSFET. Right, so that's all. Not much at all. Then we have a combination of it. And from that, we could start actually to go to different kind of noises that are created there. And Turkey.
Okay, really good.
Yeah, well, in this day and age, there's been a lot of advances in getting the noise figures of devices much lower than they have been when they were first invented, of course. Your New Vista 2, which I know I work with New Vistas, and the little metal tubes that are used as the preamplifiers, they've been around a long time, and one of the advantages of a New Vista tube is that it has a low noise figure. The noise figure of the tube is low. I don't know what the actual number is, but it's lower than most tubes, and it's used in a higher frequency circuit because of that. So they've been experimenting with these devices, even in the tube category for a long time. But now, with the other chemicals, gallium arsenide, and there's MOSFETs, and the JFETs, and the list goes on and on. I mean, there's been a lot of advances in decreasing the noise level and increasing the performance of the radio, the radios that we buy, like what they have a name called MDS, minimum discernible signal, which is measured in dB, and then you have reciprocal I forgot the name of it. Anyway, factors of that nature. So they've come a long way, but we could talk about the various components that have come out to increase performance in the future. When I saw this on semiconductors, it's intriguing. It's caught my eye. But again, as John said, you got to keep it. I got to keep it within the realm where everyone can understand it. What I'm talking about. Anyway, bottom line, I'm keeping it as a tech net. Thanks, Roy. Let me give it to you because it's after 9:30, and maybe you want to move on to some other topics at this point. So this is an abbreviated sort of Andy's Corner, WA2CDL, and good to be back, Roy. Back to you.
Well, it's great to have you back, Andy. Thank you very much. I look forward to future Andy's Corners. I enjoyed past Andy's Corners, and I appreciate the effort that you put in. I think we'll bottle noise for the time being. I want to get back to Rich. He checked in that he had some questions earlier tonight. Before I go to Rich, though, I just want to mention a nice thing. In the very old days, when Dick was running this, we used to have two Canadian repeaters on IRLP. Unfortunately, we had some problems with our IRLP, and when it came back, one of the two Canadian repeaters kind of dropped out of the schedule. So for the last few years, it's been us and Barry in Ontario, Canada. But we picked up another IRLP repeater, the Lake of Bays Huntsville, also in Ontario, Canada. So we welcome them to the Limark Technical Net, and I hope you stick around. We're here every Sunday night, so please feel free to listen, and if you're so inclined, transmit. So I just wanted to kind of wave of a hand to Lake of Bays Huntsville in Ontario, Canada repeater. Anyway, this is AC2GS. Rich, I hope you're still there, and I hope you still got your questions. So what are they tonight?
All right. Well, there are actually two questions. I had a very, very strange thing happen to my Anytone 868. As you know, I own it. It's been a solid radio. It's been a great radio since the day I bought it. But last week during the TechNet, something very strange happened. I have a one-channel program to TAC 310 and another channel, amongst many others, programmed to the Limark Glen Oaks repeater. And during the middle of the TechNet, I heard the Limark Glen Oaks repeater on the TAC 310 channel in the radio. And it wasn't an overload situation because Glen Oaks is much lower than Selden, you know, and it was the Glen Oaks repeater that the radio was picking up on my TAC 310 channel. Now, you know, the first thing you think of is memory. Something happened with the memory. Something got overwritten. But no matter how I think about it, none of it makes sense. So maybe somebody out there who knows more about these radios, and I don't think it's, you know, particularly a DMR problem or anything like that, nor is it a programming problem, but somehow, as I said, I heard the Glen Oaks repeater on my TAC 310 channel. Any ideas, Roy, or anybody else?
Well, just to make sure it's not a memory problem, you checked the entry of that channel and checked that it was pointed at, I guess it was pointed at your hotspot in your home?
Yeah, no, it was, everything else was working fine, and it hasn't happened since. So I haven't heard Glen Oaks, I didn't check tonight, but I haven't heard Glen Oaks on the TAC 310 channel, and it's not an entry error. It's not like I put in, you know, Limark Glen Oaks information into my TAC 310 channel. The radio, except for that, hasn't had a hiccup in over a year. So I don't know how the memory could have gotten overwritten, or I just have no idea, Roy. Go ahead.
Okay, did you after me?
Yes, I didn't quite catch the call sign.
Okay, did you after me? I spell Kilo, Delta 2, Foxtrot, Julia, Bravo.
Oh, okay. Good to have you here, Lee. You have some suggestions?
I have two. Number one, do you have scan enabled? Do you have a scan list with Limark in that list? And number two, if I recall, the 878 to 868 dirt, you know, VHF, UHF dual VFO, correct? So you can have a UHF hotspot and a VHF analog repeater
on the second VFO. Could that have been the issue?
I mean, that's not a bad idea that I didn't check it, you know, whether the VFO-B somehow took over where VFO-A should have been. What I'm going to do is, after my little second question here, I'm going to check it again to see if the same thing's happening. And by the way, I can only hear Glen Oaks out here in Riverhead at night for some reason. It's a past question, I guess, but I could only receive Glen Oaks at night. But I'll check to see if the same thing's happening. The first point you made, I missed. Could you repeat the first point?
I believe those radios have a feature for scanning, so you can be on a channel, and if you have a scan list assigned to your personality, if you had this Glen Oaks repeater in that scan list, the radio could have scanned to it, and you would have heard it.
It's also a compelling suggestion. Yeah, I do have a scan list programmed into it, but I did not think of going to check the scan list if Glen Oaks is part of the scan list. But two very interesting ideas to check out. And like I said, I'm going to check it tonight again to see if it's doing it again. All right. Let me just turn it over to Roy again before I ask my second question. Do you have anybody else have any other ideas? The 878 and the 868 are virtually the same radio.
AC2GS. Well, Lee had two very good suggestions. I don't think I could think of any others. I would imagine that if it was an aspect of the scanning, it would show up on the display as the other repeater. But as he mentioned, if you have the two tuners set for different things, anything's possible. So that's a good set of reasons why, Lee. If anyone else has any good ideas, please feel free to hit the push-to-talk button. Yes?
This is obviously a rare occurrence, but someone might have been retransmitting from one receive to transmit on another frequency.
Okay, so you think that maybe someone was just cross-transmitting on the same frequency as Rich's hotspot?
It's very, very unlikely, but it's possible.
Okay, well, yeah, that certainly is a possibility. If someone is, I know of cases where neighbors use hotspots and the frequencies collide. I borrowed a hotspot from a neighbor of mine, lives a block away. And I didn't realize that I had to change the frequency setting because apparently he used that frequency in his own home. So every time I used my hotspot, he would sort of hear the signal over in his hotspot area. So I guess it's possible, certainly.
Yeah, and comical. That's a funny example. AC2PL, back to that.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I got a bunch of them, and there's no cover charge.
And I never did check TAC 310 against anything before last weekend, and it was just a mistake. I turned the knob. I was AMBing Selden and Glen Oaks, and I just turned the knob the other way, and TAC 310 came up, but I was hearing Glen Oaks repeater, so I'll do it again tonight, see if I can duplicate it. then the thing I'm going to do is I'll copy the memory, you know, to the computer, and then I'll reset the radio and copy it back. All right, the other question is, besides more functions, what's the difference between a PAN adapter and a spectrum analyzer?
Well, I don't know if it's a strict definition. Usually a PAN adapter has some other features involved in it, whereas a spectrum analyzer is just a very simple, you know, frequency versus amplitude. And there's no real time dimension, whereas most PAN adapters will have a secondary display that gives you the amplitude over time, and you see that by a little scrolling window. So you can actually look at the below the PAN adapter at the waterfall, I guess you'd call it, and see Morse code in action, because since the waterfall has a time component portion instead of just frequency versus amplitude, you can track the change in the amplitude over time as well. So I think that's the significant difference. I don't think it's kind of hard-coded into the dictionary. You can theoretically get a PAN adapter that doesn't have a waterfall, but most PAN adapters tend to have that feature as well, because it's not that difficult to implement, especially in software-defined radios.
PAN adapter, can you see the sidebands of a sideband transmission?
Yes, you can. As I've mentioned before, that if you have a bit of experience with your PAN adapter, you can tell the difference between a single sideband and an amplitude modulated, and certainly a CW. And it's a little bit more difficult to discern the waveform of a frequency modulated signal, but sometimes I think I can do that too. So, yeah, you can definitely see whether it's an upper sideband or a lower sideband. We've talked about that in the past because most voice, the lower registers have much more amplitude than the higher frequencies. And so towards the center where the carrier wave would be would tend to give you the strongest voice amplitude signal. And as you roll down to the 3 kilohertz away from the zero beat carrier wave frequency, it kind of goes down to next to nothing. And, you know, so yeah, you can definitely see single sidebands. You can tell the difference between upper and lower just by a quick blink of the eye.
And could you use the spectrum analyzer to pick out, you know, signals in, you know, above the noise floor?
Yes. It's a frequency versus amplitude in real time, or with a slight latency error because it takes a little time to process the information. But you can see signals and you can get a good idea of what the noise floor is. And anything that pokes up above the noise floor is visible on a PAN adapter or a spectrum analyzer display. And with some of these machines, you just take your cursor and you click to the place where you want it to land. And if the software has a proper setting for the steps that it takes, you lock on and you listen. Otherwise, if you're off and you've set it for 100 hertz intervals, you might have to tweak your VFO electronically or manually to get the single side band signal sounding quite right. Otherwise, they'd be a soprano or a basso type of guy.
Okay, I lied. I have one more question. I know it could get very deep, but if you could just give a very, very, very basic introduction to I and Q signals as they apply to software-defined radios, the difference between I and Q and how they're used, just at the very basic level, Roy.
AC2GS. Okay, I mean, Ed kind of did a talk on INQ. I is basically a shorthand term for in-phase signal. So I signals are zero phase difference from the signal you're getting from the front end of your radio. The radio is the antenna feeds into the front end. The front end is a broad frequency, low noise RF amplifier. And so that signal, for all intents and purposes, is the I signal. The Q signal is a quadrature delayed signal. Well, what does a quadrature delayed signal mean? Well, these things are kind of in terms of sine waves and such, so it means that the waveform is 90 degrees delayed. So it's the quadrature is 90, 180, 270, 360. When you get to 360, you're back at the starting position. So one quadrant is 90 degrees. So a quadrature delayed signal is the Q of the IQ signals. Using the I and the Q signals is very, very useful and important for the digital manipulation of radio signals. It is using both of those signals once they're digitized that allows a central processing unit to apply different types of algorithms that allow you to demodulate a signal. So if you just had the I signal or just had the Q signal and you did not even usually what's done, what used to be done was there was a, something called a Talo detector that used a logic flip-flop that supplied the I and the Q, and that would go into the digitizer. Nowadays, what happens usually is the front end feeds directly to the digitizer, and the Q wave is then mathematically synthesized. Once the initial radio and the I signal is digitized. So you need the I and the Q. Let me drop for a sec. Okay. So if you just have the I and you just have the Q, then it's very, very difficult to algorithmically combine the digital values and demodulate the RF signal. Demodulate frequency-modulated signals, demodulate phase, demodulate amplitude-modulated, all these things. So you need the I and the Q to plug it into the CPU and to manipulate the data points of both the I and the Q to get you the demodulated signal. That's primarily why we needed an I and a Q signal. So we got it originally at the point of the detector right past the front end, and once we had enough power in our silicon, we were just able to take the I signal and synthesize a Q signal that we could use with it to manipulate the data and demodulate the transmissions.
Was the I and Q signals used for anything else before SDR radios came into being?
Well, as Ed, WB2EAV mentioned, military and very expensive commercial radios apparently use them too for to demodulate the signal. The exact ways that they did that, I don't really know because I really didn't research too much because, you know, a lot of these are kind of military-grade equipment, and as the saying goes, it's above my pay grade. So I'm not exactly sure, but according to Ed, and I believe him, heavy-duty, high-end, ultra-expensive military radios implemented IQ signals in their design as well for, I guess, legacy radios, although in my experiences, when you go looking for manipulating IQ signals, you almost always land on software-defined radio algorithms. So I'm not quite sure what the analog circuits use the I and the Q in order to demodulate things.
that's all understandable. A good start for me to really know what's going on in those SDR radios, since it is all of our futures. So, all right, Roy, thank you. Back to TechNet.
Okay, you're welcome. Yeah, the problem with software-defined radios as time goes on is it gives people, unfortunately, more of a chance to not understand what's going on, because the computer algorithms for FIR filters and RIR filters and all the fun little algorithms that go on within the CPU, it's way too easy to think of them as just mysterious black boxes that get the job done. It's a little bit more easier, in my humble opinion, to kind of understand what IF stages do and mixers do and amplifying circuits do. But when you get to computer algorithms, unless you like computers a lot, you tend to stay away from them. So unfortunately, my perception of future technology, and I'm a big proponent of software-defined radio, I think it's going to improve efficiency, decrease size, decrease price points, add more flexible features, et cetera, is that it's going to lead to a greater number of us amateur radio operators just kind of treating it as a magic box. But hopefully not. We'll see.
Very well said.
Thank you. Well, now that we have a little bit of a pause, maybe I'll do my little micro puzzle. Now, you know, I never know with these puzzles. Sometimes these puzzles can go on for an hour. Sometimes someone answers them in the chat room, and it takes about 20 seconds. My guess is it's going to be closer to 20 seconds. But, and especially Paul, of course, unfortunately, he's not able to talk on the radio tonight, but I'm sure he knows all of this. So my little micro puzzle for tonight, and if you do have a computer or an iPad or a cell phone nearby, I would suggest at the very least you do use my link page. You go to roy.ac2gs.com because there's a picture towards the very, very top. And what it is, it's a picture of the James Webb Space Telescope. Now, there's something about that image that can only come from the James Webb Space Telescope, as far as I'm aware. It is a classic indication of its origin. It could not come from James Webb, and as far as I know, I don't know of any other similar type of a telescope that gives you the indication that I can see just looking at it. So I'm curious, people out there, take a look at the image of the Cartwheel Galaxy. It was very popular. It's been shown all around this last week. And if you have an idea of why that image is kind of stamped as a product of the James Webb Telescope, please tell me.
PDH with a comment.
Yes, John. Yes, John, please.
Yeah, I think the image has a local star. By local, I mean a star in our galaxy, and it's showing up with a cross pattern across it. I think that interference pattern on a cross pattern, I think it's either six or eight-legged, which is characteristic of the mirrors of the James Webb scope.
Okay, very good. You get the gold star. It has eight points. What's going on is it's a diffraction rays. It's due to optical refraction of the telescope. Now, the main mirror of the James Webb Space Telescope are an array of six-sided mirrors with small gaps between each of them. And those small gaps will produce a diffraction rays, six diffraction rays for a very, very bright pinpoint light source. So you have any guesses of what's producing the eighth, you know, the seventh and eighth point? I think that was Jeff.
Isn't it the support for the other mirror that comes out?
Yes, it is the struts. But there are three struts. So why aren't there six more diffraction rays?
I got to beg out of that one.
Okay. Anyone else out there have any good ideas?
About VDH?
Yes, John.
I think those other diffraction struts lie on top of the ones covered, caused by the mirror, so you really don't notice them because the ones from the mirror are predominating.
AC2GS, you are absolutely positively right again, John. The engineers knew that the struts were going to impose these diffraction rays, and they were able to manipulate the orientation of those three struts in relation to the six-sided reflectors in such a way to have four of the six diffraction rays coincide with the same area of same place that the rays come from the diffraction of the primary mirror. So there was only one set that they couldn't align, so that's why you get the six, which are strong. And depending upon how bright the object is, you may be able to recognize that eighth line, you know, the seventh and eighth rays that are kind of straight lines there. They're weaker amplitudes. So if you blow that picture of the cartwheel galaxy, you'll notice that the seven and eight rays are much less bright than the other six. And if the difference is even, if the illumination is lower and all of those diffraction rays are less, you might miss the seventh and eighth diffraction rays. But you got it right. Now, how many diffraction rays would you see in something like the Hubble telescope? Anyone want to hazard a guess? Gosh, I'm sort of amazed. You know, I mean, usually people will just kind of give me at least a random number. But anyone want to kind of hazard a guess of the starburst or diffraction ray aberrations produced by the Hubble telescope? We've seen thousands of Hubble telescope images in all these years. You know, it's a kind of a new experience to see James Webb images.
VDH.
Yes, John. Yes, indeed. Once again, John, you might have built this thing. Yes, the Hubble doesn't have any aberrations. Its mirror is, I think, a single large mirror. It's a smaller mirror than the James Webb. I believe it's something like 1. Let's see, what the hell? It's about 2.4 meters in diameter, but it's a solid one, so there's no hexagon-shaped segments, whereas the James Webb is about 6.5 meters in diameter. So there's no real diffraction aberration from the primary lens, but the secondary lens is held on with four struts. And those four struts produce four diffraction rays. So when you see usually four diffraction rays, you're looking at an old Hubble. And if you have that lovely little 6+2, you're looking at the nice new and shiny James Webb Space Telescope. So let me ask people another question, and John probably knows this one as well. Is the image of the cartwheel galaxy that we're looking at, because they didn't do any digital cleaning up of the diffraction rays, so is that a kind of close to real-life image that we're seeing, or have the wonderful guys at NASA manipulated the data for that image, and you wouldn't recognize it if you saw the raw image?